Kathleen Lynn was a radical and a revolutionary, a suffragist, a socialist and a politician. She's known to many people for her participation in the 1916 Rising, but Lynn's battles and campaigns extended far beyond the revolutionary period. Lynn was a pioneering medical professional, a doctor who established and maintained one of Ireland's most important hospitals. Lynn was also a diarist. For nearly four decades before her death in 1955, she kept a daily record of her life, a life spent in the company of her fellow activist, Madeleine French Mullen, and their many friends, a life spent offering care, protection and hope for their many patients. To discuss that life, I'm joined by Dr. Mary McAuliffe, historian, lecturer and director of gender studies at University College Dublin, and Harriet Wheelock, Keeper of Collections at the Royal College of Physicians of Ireland, in whose archives the original diaries are stored. They are co-editors of a new book, The Diaries of Kathleen Lynn, A Life Revealed Through Personal Writing. Mary and Harriet, you're both very welcome indeed to the History Show. Before we discuss the diaries, Harriet, give us a brief account of Kathleen Lynn's life and career up to 1916, if you would.
So Kathleen Lynn, she's born in Mayo. She's educated first at home, then she goes to Alexander College in Dublin. And that's really where she begins to get involved in many of the movements that will dominate later into her life. And it's from influences in her family. There's a doctor in her family who she's very influenced by. And it's through that. And then from, I think, as well, meeting medics when she's in Alexander College, that she decides she wants to train as a doctor herself. She's in kind of the second generation of women who go into medicine in Ireland. So women have been able to access medical education for about 20 years when Lynn begins. And she registers with the Royal College of Science, now part of UCD. And that's where she undertakes her medical training and in hospitals in Dublin, particularly the Adelaide Hospital.
And she also worked, I think, in the Eyen Ear Hospital, didn't
she? Yeah, so immediately after graduation, she gets a job in the Eyen Ear Hospital and she's there until 1916, at which point she loses her position because of her activities.
Now, during that period, Mary, while she's working in the Eyen Ear Hospital, she becomes a member of the Irish Citizens Army.
She does, although that comes out of about a 10-year sort of trajectory of her life from what she admits in the latter part of her diary. She was a soft unionist. And that was very extraordinary for me to see that written down, because I had presumed she'd always been maybe a cultural nationalist or a soft nationalist. But actually, given her family background, I suppose it isn't surprising. She is the daughter of a Church of Ireland clergyman, related to the Gorboots of Lissadel and many of that Anglo-Irish upper middle class and ascendancy. So she takes that trajectory from soft unionism through suffrage campaigning to cultural nationalism and then to socialism and joining the Irish Citizen Army in 1913. Firstly, of course, becoming very much involved in providing care for those who were out in the great lockout strike of 1913 through Liberty Hall, and gets to know James Connolly, who always said of Kathleen Lynn that she was the best of us, and really is influenced by Connolly's ideologies and writings, but also about her by her own educational background. But you have to remember as well, in Alexandra College, they had a real ideology of practical philanthropy, of seeing the poverty that was in Dublin. And she was very much engaged in that from a teenage from then, and worked through Alexandra College and various groups there to alleviate poverty in the tenements in Dublin. So I think she was a mind already open to ideas of socialism, ideas of poverty alleviation, of better housing for the poor in Dublin, better healthcare, obviously, as a doctor. And that she found a response to that politically through Connolly's writings, through trade union activism, and then her growing nationalism through the Irish Citizen Army.
Tell me then about her experience of the 1916 Rising itself.
Well, she is one of the few people in Dublin, other than somebody like the O'Rahilly, who has a car. And so she delivers a lot of the first aid equipment to the various outposts, to Stephen's Green before they retreated to the College of Surgeons and various other places. And then she is to position herself in what was supposed to be Dublin Castle, but as we know, they didn't take it. Instead, they took City Hall. And apparently, she had to climb over the railings to get into City Hall. So the Irish Citizen Army garrison is there before she arrives. And within minutes of her arrival, she's up on the roof and she is there when the commandant, Sean Connolly, no relation to James, is shot dead. she holds him in her arms. And she says in the diaries, she knew instantly there was nothing she could do for him. It was a headshot. And he died with her and with Helena Maloney and Jenny Davis, both of whom she had trained in first aid, by his side. Another two officers of the Citizen Army are then killed in the course of the day. So by the time the evening comes and the British have bored their way in through the back wall of City Hall, she's the senior officer and she's the one who gives the surrender on Easter Monday evening. So in effect, her rising lasts about 8 or 9 hours at most. And she spends the rest of the week with the City Hall garrison in Ship Street Barracks, which she gives vivid descriptions of how awful it was. Unhygienic, terrible food. They were mistreated verbally. And there is some hint of mistreatment of the women, when particularly when they were using the bathroom, of, you know, doors being taken off and soldiers not giving them privacy. So there's a lot of detail about that experience during the week.
And then what happens to her in the courts martial? Where does she end up after the rising?
Well, she is taken from Ship Street to Kilmainham Jail, where happily she and Madeline are reunited, and they spend a few days there. And now they're there when the executions start. And after about 10 days of the 77 women imprisoned after the rising, almost 70 of them are released. But the more, I suppose, the ones the authorities considered most dangerous are shipped off to Mountjoy, including Markovitch, Kathleen Lynn, and a few others. And she's very upset because even though Mountjoy is nicer than Kilmainham in terms of hygiene, she said she'd give £10,000 for Kilmainham and Madeline, because Madeline and she are separated at that stage. So she spends a short time there. And then there is a decision about what to do with her, because they don't want to release her. So she is excluded from Ireland. She's sent to England under DORA regulations, and she's supposed to stay there, but she doesn't stay there for very long.
Now, during 1916, that's when she starts to first keep a diary, Harriet, a practice she maintains for the next almost 40 years. The diaries, however, they're written in a kind of an idiosyncratic style. Give us an idea of how they're laid out. What is the style of these diaries?
So
how detailed are they?
Initially, she's in 1916, in the days after the rising, she's writing while in prison. So they're written on scraps of paper, which is presumably all she had. And we have those scraps. And then at some point later, probably around 1918, 1919, she starts transferring those early entries into volumes, which she then continues to use. So unlike a normal diary, when you write the 1st of January and then the 2nd of January and then the 3rd of January, Lynn takes one double page spread for the 1st of January. And the first line is the year 1916. The next line is the year 1917. The next line, the year 1918. So you get about 20 years worth of one day's activities across a page. And then because it's one small line, she's then cramming three or four lines of writing into that space. So they're very short entries. She uses lots of abbreviation. She uses lots of kind of almost like her own code or shorthand to get a huge amount into a very small space. And because of the way she's writing them, there's quite a lot of reflection back, because obviously when she's writing her entries for each day, she's got what happened the previous year and previous years as she goes further in above her. So particularly towards the end of her life, there's a lot of reflection back on key days, you know, 10 years since the rising, 20 years.
To be blunt about it, is it a bit of a head wreck?
Yeah, and she does have typical Dr. Tan writing. There's no way around it. Working in the College Archives, I could probably say that. She has very, very difficult to read handwriting. Also, in the early years, her house was being raided. She probably didn't want it to make it too easy for people to read what she was writing. Very, very hard to read.
Okay. And Mary, given the complexity of the source material, there's so much material, you have 40 years of material here. Describe the editing process.
Well, we were very lucky in that the handwritten diaries have been transcribed and they were done. And I don't know how she did it, but all credit is due to her, to Margaret Connolly, who did
now,
it.
Now, Saint Margaret Connolly.
Saint Margaret Connolly, yes. Who did it over 2 or 3 years?
3 years, yeah.
3 years. And she said it was like unpicking knitwear, yeah, or something like that, that she concentrated on each word. So sometimes the sentences to her lost context. It was just the word. But we did measure just to test, and she absolutely got everything right as far as we could see. So we had those texts, but it's almost a million words of a diary. So we couldn't publish a million words, but we didn't want to lose Lynn's personality, her voice, what was important to her, the different things she was involved in, whether politics or medical, her medical profession or healthcare or traveling around the world or the relationship with Madeleine. And then the network of women that she was involved in and all sorts of different pieces of activism over the years. So we took our time and over the process, and luckily we were doing this through COVID as well, so there was time. We did several different editings of it, at least four. We decided to keep each entry complete. Mm. We weren't going to shorten the entries because that is her staccato rhythm, is the way I think of it. It's her voice coming at you each day. And then there were periods when we know she's in Glenmalure every August. So nothing much happens there except they're down there having their holidays. So we can include a number of entries for that in each year, but we don't have to include a lot because they are just having a good time and having fun. But it's interesting to see who comes and visits them and their relationships with the local people, which were excellent. But we really wanted to keep her work as a doctor, her work in St. Dalton's, and the fact that the fundraising they had to do to keep that going, the fights, obviously, around the time of the amalgamation with Harcourt Street, which unfortunately didn't happen, her work as a local councillor, her interest in social housing and better education and public hygiene and healthcare, the doctors in St. Dalton's, which is really a female space, which is very interesting. You don't get that about medical histories very much, because most hospitals, although a lot of them are founded by nuns, the doctors are men. So this is a female space where you have female doctors, female nurses. You would have men working there, but mostly they're janitorial staff. The innovations they introduced to St. Dalton's, they start out with two cots, £70 in the bank, and a couple of goats. And I found the idea of the goats very interesting because they are providing goat's milk for the children who maybe might be allergic to breast milk or dairy milk. Just, and I hope, and I think we did manage to keep who and what Kathleen Lynn was by, we only have 10% of the diaries really in the book, but I think it gives a real sense of who she was in her entirety.
Looking at the diaries, one of the things that struck me was the number of references, and they're all necessary. There are no superfluous references. You've got to kind of, you as editors have to decipher who's she talking about? What is she talking about? What does she mean?
Oh, yeah, because she just throws in names. Sometimes it's a surname. Sometimes it's a nickname. Sometimes it's Mr. This or Mrs. That. And we had to figure out who they were from their names, the context in which he's writing. And newspapers were invaluable for that, as were other archives. So we went and looked at other archives, who people were talking about, what was happening at this time, why would she be interacting with these people, what are the newspapers saying. And we had to do an awful lot of work around that. And the other archives in the physicians were invaluable, weren't they?
Yeah, particularly for the medics, because there's a lot of staff going through the hospital and she talks about them all. So working out who they were, mostly from their name and the date in the medical registers, you can pick them up. And then internationally as well, because she has a lot of links. They're travelling, they're going to America, they're going to Europe, they're meeting with the leading doctors at the time, they're bringing back ideas. And she talks about all of that in the diary.
Tell me, Mary's already mentioned St. Dalton's Hospital, St. Dalton's Hospital for Sick Infants, co-founded in 1919. Tell us a little bit about that hospital.
Yeah, so the hospital was set up really, it's kind of the bridge between the maternity hospitals and then sort of hospitals for older children. So they're taking children between 2 and 5, well, up to 2 years old, and then later they push it up to 5 years. And it's on Charlemont Street. It was right in the centre of the kind of really deprived areas in Dublin. And they were providing medical care, obviously, but they were providing a huge amount of social care as well. They did lots of things. They provided what we now sort of they had an almoner, so they were doing social work. They were providing food. They were providing education to mothers and how to look after their children.
At a time when mortality rates were
incredibly
very, very high.
Yeah. And there's a photograph album in the archive from St. Dalton's where they take pictures for the first 2 or 3 years of the hospital, and they take pictures of all the patients coming in, and most of the babies that are coming in are severely malnourished, and you can see that. And there's a picture of them when they're leaving as well, so you can see the changes that the hospital's having. And they really create a community. They have a party every year where they invite back what they call our children, so all their patients are invited back. They keep track on them as they grow older. They have one early patient who becomes a champion Irish dancer, so he's always appearing in pictures in the annual report saying, look how well our babies are doing now. There's a real sense of community, and it's not just, it's the whole child. It's not just the illness.
Yeah, I mean, there was a philosophy, wasn't there?
Yeah, it was very much about the whole child. They introduce education. So Maria Montessori comes to visit the hospital in the 30s. They have a Montessori teacher in the hospital, particularly when they start taking in TB patients who are there for longer. They obviously need to provide educational support for them. They introduce vaccination. There's, you know, really revolutionary ideas and often against a fair amount of opposition.
And Mary St. Olton's a remarkable success story, but she, Kathleen Lynn, very, very farsighted. She wants to create a national children's hospital, doesn't she?
She does. Now, the suggestion does come initially from the hospital sweepstakes, and they're very lucky. They're one of the hospitals that is getting funding from the sweepstakes during this time. And it does help them a bit, because before that, they were doing all sorts of things for funding, saints days and at homes and all of that. So that helps them a lot. So Harcourt Street, which is also a secular hospital, and St. Alton's were seen as the two that should come together to create a national children's hospital. Michael Scott, the architect, now famed for many of his designs, had been a good friend and had designed things for a number of additions onto the St. Alton's, and indeed the famous balcony on Kathleen's own house that she spent a lot of time on. Great admirer of fresh air, believed in it totally, and sunshine. And he designed this beautiful hospital that would have stretched from Charleman Street Bridge to, I think, Rathmines Bridge. Yeah. And this whole idea was to create a big hospital which would incorporate all the innovative ideas that Lynn had brought in, enough beds to, you know, service basically the city and the country, and they could grow from there. And they started buying up land all around Charleman Street to create that. However, opposition came, and came very strongly from the Archbishop of Dublin, Edward Byrne, and the his right-hand man, John Charles McQuaid, his successor, and the Catholic doctors and secular conservative Catholic allies of the church. And that opposition put pay to it. Basically, they felt that every hospital in the country needed to have a Catholic ethos and be staffed by doctors trained through the Catholic system, and not be a secular hospital where there might be, God forbid, sex education, information on contraceptives, proselytization, all of that sort of thing, which they were accused of potentially maybe doing if the hospital went ahead. They did have a meeting with Archbishop Byrne. Lynn says in her diaries he was very superior to them, you know, just totally dismissed them, didn't listen to any of their arguments, and the whole plan just fizzled out. I mean, being a very practical woman, she does return to it every so often and was very disappointed it never happened. But she moves on then, and they start the vaccination programme, the BCG, with Dr. Dorothy Stopford Price leading it. There was opposition to that too as well, but they got that going. But I think the fact that Lynn led this idea of the new National Children's Hospital really kind of supports the idea we should call the one that's being, if it's ever built, constructed right now, after her.
Indeed. The diaries make clear, Harriet, that she had a large social network to rely upon, particularly her life partner, Madeleine French Mullen. Tell us a little bit about that relationship, if you would.
Yeah, so Lynn and French Mullen, they meet before the diary starts. So they meet in 1913,
14. About 1913, 14. We're not quite sure when, but sometime around then.
Apparently, Lynn is teaching first aid to a group of Cwmwn y Bon women, and Madeleine French Mullen falls off her seat laughing at something, and Lynn picks her up, and it's all good from there. So they're living together in the house in Rathmines, and you really get a sense in the diaries of how many people there are coming through the house. Like both families, although Lynn does have trouble with her family immediately after 1916, later on, so things do clear out. Madeleine's family are very present there. They go and visit each other. Lynn's aunt Florence, his peers frequently in the diary, and then all their friends, joint friends as well. And it's interesting when Mary was looking at people referring to them, they're always referred to together. It's always the doctor and Madeleine. They come, they are seen in their circle as a couple. And, you know, people come to visit them as a couple. And then after Madeleine dies, it does change. And it's different friends coming through. She still has her old friends, although Lynn talks a lot, particularly as she ages, about how sad it is that funerals are the place where you see all your friends. But she has new generations of her family, the younger generations that she's clearly very close to. And there is a lot of support and love and friendship in her life, I think.
Yes, she never stops missing Madeleine.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's incredibly well connected, which I think makes these diaries of huge social importance, historical importance, rather than just being examples of, for a couple of years, revolutionary history and then medical history.
Oh, absolutely. And she does continue to be a very politically aware and politically active player in many ways. For instance, she is very much part of the campaign against inserting the Women in the Home articles into the 1937 Constitution. So she remains very well connected with all the suffrage women. Hannah Shee Skeffington, of course, is a neighbour in the last decades of their lives. And they have a bit of a falling out over Hannah leaving Sinn Féin to join Fianna Fáil. But then they make it up within a year. She knows every leading female activist and most of the male political activists, social activists, medical doctors, certainly in Dublin and probably in the country. She herself is a very well-known person, and she continues to be very active in all those areas. You know, social housing is a huge issue of hers. So they, herself and Madeline, are on the Rathmines Urban District Council. They campaign for social housing and end up, again, Michael Scott designing, getting the Charlemont Street flats built, which are really a replacement for the tenements and a very forward-thinking design of what you can do to create proper social housing. So those connections stay with her all of her life. You can see even to the last few months of her life when she's writing her last entries, she's talking about being tired, but she's still very engaged in what's going on. So, you know, her network of friends and her network of political allies overlap a huge amount.
And for all the reasons that we've heard, the Kathleen Lynn National Children's Hospital has an appropriate ring to it, doesn't it?
Oh, I think so. Absolutely. You know, this was a woman who dedicated her life to the health and well-being of infants and children, found innovative technologies, ensured that she did what she could to make sure the infant mortality rates were coming down. You can see in the diaries, she loved every one of her patients. She meant if one of them failed to thrive and if they died, she mourns them in the diaries. And as Harriet said, they had this whole child ideology in St. Alton's Hospital, led by Kathleen. And I think no better woman to have the National Children's Hospital named after.
Absolutely. Dr. Mary McAuliffe and Harriet Wheelock, many thanks for joining us on The History Show this evening to talk about the diaries of Kathleen Lynn, A Life Revealed Through Personal Writing, published by UCD Press. After the break, we'll be looking at the origins of AI and the life of the Irish-American professor who coined the term artificial intelligence. Stay with us.